You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
This comes out of work that we've been doing, it feels like forever. We've been writing this chapter for a forthcoming book on video games, ethics, morality. I want to start by thanking all of you for being here on this gorgeous day. On a day like today, there's nothing better to do than pull down the shades and fire up the Xbox, so thank you so much for being here. Just by a show of hands, I'm curious if anybody here plays video games on a console, like a Nintendo DS or a PlayStation, if you on some kind of regular basis, just so I know. On a semi-regular, okay, all right, and or maybe on the computer or on the web, like, you know, solitaire counts, anyway, on your mobile phones. How about, like, in the newspaper, like, do you do crossword puzzles and things like that? Does anybody still have a newspaper? Okay. Board games, does anybody here play board games? Sports, play sports. How many of you would call yourself gamers? Okay, so this is, I just wanted to get a kind of a temperature of the room and what your familiarity is with different kinds of games. I wanted to open this presentation with a story that's set not too far from here when I was a law student and I was taking a negotiations course here at Harvard Law School. And those of you who have taken a lot of these kind of practical negotiations courses know that most of the teaching is done through games. Also known as simulations, where you basically play the role of two negotiators or multiple negotiators and you work out a deal. And in this, there was this story that was passed on from year to year of one negotiation that basically went horribly wrong between two students, where basically one student deceived the other throughout the course of a negotiation, or at least seemed to. And at the end of that session, the one partner went up to the other and said, that their friendship was essentially over, and added, if this is how you behave, and the other person said, well, you know, I don't see what the problem is, because it's only a game, it's just a game. And the other person replied, well, you know, if this is how you behave in a game, I would hate to see how you would act when the stakes are real. And this is kind of a tension that runs throughout studies of games, as to what extent it's real and to what extent it's a separate space. And this is the dilemma we face when we talk about pro-social learning in games. And it points out one of the core issues of any kind of learning in games, which is what's the permeability, the transferability of what you're doing inside that game environment and what you then end up doing in real life. There's a very similar story that's relayed by some researchers who had been studying how kids actually play games, which is interestingly very understudied. They had written up on a teenage girl who plays the game Zoo Tycoon, which some of you may be familiar with. You basically manage a zoo. And they noted what seemed like a paradox that I'll be kind of referring to a couple times in this presentation. And what they wrote is that in her everyday life, Rachel, the girl they were studying, and her family cared for stray and abandoned cats awaiting adoption through a local animal shelter. We often observed her readily pause her game to monitor a cat's health or attend to its needs. However, in game, Rachel's decisions about the animals she was caring for as a zookeeper were driven by monetary gain rather than the happiness or well-being of the animals. For example, while creating a zoo for different types of cats, and they found this particularly interesting because she deals with real-life cats. Rachel learned of a new birth in her zoo and responded by selling the newborn animals immediately. And she said to the researchers, yeah, you know, the baby, it's an endangered animal. That's really great, and especially great for me because I can sell the little baby for $1,000. That's a really good deal. And then they kind of, the researchers then probe her a little bit on, well, you know, would you do this in your day-to-day life? And she said, in real life, I wouldn't manage a zoo like this. I'd be much more caring, but in this game, I'm more greedy, but that's okay. And one of the questions that often arises around video games is that okay? The way that you behave within the game is different, perhaps, than the moral code that you might follow when you're in real life, or are they different? Are they the same? What is the value of that? Just want to pause for a second and talk briefly about why my interest in video games as opposed to the games. I've asked before whether people here played other kinds of games, including sports. Some of the things that are interesting about video games, or you can call them computer games, there's some debate over terminology, is that a computer is managing the system of rules. So there's some kind of objective thing that is there managing the game for you. And it, in some cases, it fully instantiates the entire game. The entire game is contained within that computer simulation. Or sometimes it kind of adjudicates outcomes, and there's other kinds of interactions that are around the computer. Another interesting thing is that it allows for a wide range of player configurations. Most of the time when you're playing a game, it's you and other people. Maybe not so much with a crossword puzzle, but in computer games or video games, though, you can have the player take on a system, you can have the player take on artificial players that the computer animates, you can have the player play other human players, and what's particularly interesting is they can play many, many, many people, not just like three or four or even 20, but thousands, what are known as massively multiplayer games, and you can have some mixture of all of the above. You can have human beings playing the computer, the whole system, as well as artificial players, as well as other human beings all at the same time. And that's unique and that's new to the technology that we haven't really seen before the kind of the whole explosion in video games. So what do we mean by pro-social? It's kind of a difficult term that maybe Scott can jump into. Because there's a whole range of different approaches to how you would talk about what is sometimes called moral education or character education. We're trying to find a term that's not politically loaded, and we ended up with pro-social. It's a little bit confusing because we do want to distinguish pro-social from just social. Some of you may be familiar with games like Rock Band, and that is a very social game. But that's a little bit different than what we're talking about right now, which are developing the kinds of values and attitudes that lead to what you might just call better behavior, being part of society, being a good person, which maybe Rock Band does or doesn't, but it's a little bit different than just simply being social. It's certainly different, and I think it's more, we use the word pro-social more as kind of an antithesis of anti-social, which most people have a good understanding of destructive behaviors. I think one thing that we care about in particular is not just changing people's attitudes and ways of thinking, but in particular, what is it that's going to be effective in changing behaviors? And that gets really difficult, and that's actually one of the hardest things in education generally, is you can pass a math test, but that doesn't mean that you actually know how to calculate your shopping or your grocery or your monthly budget. So there's a difference between the thinking about something and then the doing of it that we care about, and we will come back to that towards the end of this. So often when we talk about morality and values in games, unfortunately, we often start with the negative simply because that's what everybody thinks about. And it's a commonplace, especially in the media, that video games cause violence, that somehow the content of these games teach players how to think and behave in antisocial ways. And this became particularly prevalent after the Columbine massacre, where supposedly the people who perpetrated that crime were found to play Doom, which people argued this was a training program to teach people how to run around shooting, I guess, horned demons or something, but at the time, you have to realize that the graphics here were considered incredibly realistic, and we can look at it now and laugh at that, but this is generally what happens with any new technology, is it's often seen as scary, and people look at how it changes society, and there was a claim, and it's kind of still persists, that these kinds of games teach people to become violent. And there's a whole range of research in this area that I won't get too far into, that kind of uses different aggression models to show, and then I don't know, Scott, if you want to get into this, different aggression models that show how, playing different kinds of games can raise your level of aggression. often the findings are kind of blurry, and they usually use very small sample sizes, and they're often set in laboratories. So the fact that you, you know, raise your aggression level doesn't mean that you're going to go off in the street and start running people over with your car. But you know, there are some attempts to try to link these behaviors and tendencies, and it comes from this basic belief, which goes back to kind of the origins of human storytelling, even, that the content of these games matter. That as one researcher put it, kids will learn whatever messages are in the game. That when you show people running around with guns shooting each other, that's going to imprint essentially on kids and adults, but in particular we worry about kids, and teach them that it's okay to run around with guns and shoot each other. And this is rooted in a certain way of thinking about moral development that's known as character education, where the emphasis is on how people form habits through modeling. You see other people do something and you copy them. And by instruction and by practicing something over and over again. So when you watch kids playing these games where they're in these so-called first-person shooters, that, my gosh, they're running around practicing how to be killers. That's certainly what it looks like on the surface. And so there's this one approach to thinking about how games can kind of convey a certain set of values, and ultimately, as I said before, what we really care about is also a certain set of behaviors. Obviously, you can critique this from all sorts of different directions. Do games cause violence? You know, playing Microsoft Flight Simulator did not cause 9/11, even if the 9/11 terrorists used the Flight Simulator to practice, which is a horrifying thought, but to practice for their terrorist act. But it would be hard to argue that Flight Simulator caused them to do such a thing. There is research done not too far from here, at the Harvard Medical School, that is one of the very, very few to look at statistical data rather than at laboratory tests, that show that there is definitely some correlation between kids who play mature-rated games, and they were looking specifically at teenagers, and middle school kids, that they were a whole list of different kinds of behaviors that are linked to those kids who play a significant amount of mature-rated games, been in a physical fight, damaged property for fun, this entire list here, and that there's this correlation also between playing more of these games and bullying as a behavior. They are very careful to underline the fact that, as is always with the case with these kind of statistical studies, is that they can't demonstrate causation. It's possible that actually the causation runs the other direction, or that there's some other root cause, such as very lax parenting that allows you to play games for hours on end, that also leads you to all these other behaviors. So it's very hard right now to demonstrate some kind of macro link between playing more of these games or at least a direct link between playing more of these games. It could be the case that you're playing more of these games and therefore you're not doing other things that might be more constructive with your time. But in any event, that these kinds of games cause more violent behavior, it's definitely worth researching more into, because but it's very difficult research to do. And there's very little data, and it would be great to have more of it, especially like well-run research. So they're going back to the idea that to flip this around, the idea that you can practice something over and over again and kind of mold people so that they end up in the shape that you want them to be, you can also flip that around and say, well, what can we do about that on a pro-social level? And so you start thinking about games like Nintendogs, where you spend your time kind of caring for something. And any of you who have played Nintendogs or have had, like, you know, way back, if you remember the Tamagotchi keychains or things like that, it's actually quite a bit like sex ed class, when you have to pretend you have a baby. Like, this, you have to walk this dog twice a day and comb it and do all these kind of nurturing and caring activities. There's kind of an open question here: does that lead to development and cultivation of caring behaviors? And does that transfer from a virtual pet to a real pet, and then maybe from a real pet to human beings? There's all these kinds of questions that really nobody has investigated, because most of the attention being paid to character development through games has been focused on the negative, which is, you know, how is it causing us to become more aggressive? But when you look at the best-selling games, they tend to be games like this. So you have lots and lots of kids and adults. I had a Nintendo dog for about a month. And then I just realized it was more trouble than having a real dog. You know, that is that actually causing a different kind of behavior change, or at least attitudinal change, in the people who are participating in them? So very quickly, I did want to talk about other ways to look at the content of a game. And there's this great concept that Ian Bogost uses called procedural rhetoric, where it looks at how not just the story or the surface or the imagery of the game, but its actual systems, its rules, the entirety of the experience also tell you something about the world. And so going back to the story I opened with about this teenage girl, Rachel, and her experience with Zoo Tycoon, and this kind of paradox of, well, how could she treat cats so well in real life and so poorly in this game? You kind of want to look at how does this game present the idea of an animal, or in this particular case, what's a lion? And did Rachel see these zoo animals as actual animals, as real cats to care for, or rather as a set of code, as you're seeing over here on the right, which is from a cheat site, or so-called cheat site, which kind of just gives you all this data about what is a lion, which when you break it down, turns out to have all these very specific coded attributes, which you can optimize for. And in real life, you would call this kind of behavior depersonalization if you took a person and you just reduced them to a set of statistics. But again, the paradox here is we're not talking about real people. We're talking about a virtual animal. So what does that mean? We're not quite sure yet, but it's a little too easy to just say, well, what she's doing in real life is a reflection of, or what she's doing in a game is a reflection of what she's doing in real life or would do in real life. Oops. So, there are different things where that games are trying to do about tackling morality. There are games like this is Star Wars, which if you're familiar with that world, there's the dark side of the Force and the light side of the Force, and you basically pick up morality points for doing different things. You if you do more good things, you become more on the light side, and if you do more bad things, you end up more on the dark side with all the things that go along with it. And that's a very, very black and white way of looking at morality, and it's an open question there. Is that teaching people anything at all about morality? Some have argued that it's actually more like a parable about morality than it is actual morality. But, at least there are attempts to try to move in that direction. But there's which kind of points to a different way of looking at moral reasoning, moral development, which is moral reasoning, moral education, which, to go back to, why we use the word pro-social, there's often a political dimension to this. And so the character education side tends to line up with what are traditionally known as conservatives in American culture, and the moral education tends to line up with what are traditionally known as liberals, because the emphasis here is less on kind of trying to shape people's behavior and how do they act from minute to minute and their virtues, as it were, towards getting people to think, to reason, to think about what's right and wrong, rather than kind of reshape people's instincts about what's right or wrong. And so there's this other approach, which instead of saying, well, let's just get people to practice doing things like on the negative side, shooting people, on the positive side, kind of caring for a puppy, how about we get people to think about the different dilemmas that they're facing in different sophisticated ways, and then move them along what Lawrence Kohlberg had thought of as kind of a scale of moral reasoning capability, where essentially in video game terms, you level up from a very, very basic understanding of right and wrong to a very, very sophisticated concept of right and wrong. And so there's a couple of different ways to think about that. And one of them is to look at how games construct different kinds of identities, or how you construct different identities through playing these games. One of the things that some people really like about a certain kind of video game is it lets you try on different kinds of identities, and then try to find the mesh, as Jim G calls it, between your goals as a player and what the game lets you do, and in a sense what the game almost wants you to do. So as G talks about, he likes, one of the examples he gives is SWAT. There's a SWAT game, SWAT 4 specifically. And in this game, there is a certain modeling of the values of policemen, where you lose points essentially for shooting the suspect unless there's actual imminent danger to yourself or to civilians, and certainly there you lose points for shooting people who are just innocent bystanders. And it's pretty hard to play a game like this without at least being aware of these values. So games like this are conveying what David Schaefer calls the epistemology of a profession, or what he then calls epistemic games, by playing certain kinds of games that have embedded within them the values of a profession or a way of being in the world. Adopting, it doesn't mean that you're kind of adopting it for your entire life, but within the confines of the game, you're adopting the epistemology of a professional point of view, including its value system, such as don't shoot suspects, at least not in our legal system. So to go back to this Zoo Tycoon question, one thing to emphasize is that this game is called Zoo Tycoon, after all, and the whole point of being a tycoon is to make a lot of money. So it's not surprising that somebody who's playing this game, even if in real life they, take are very compassionate towards animals, that within the game they adopt a different personality, which is somebody who wants to basically amass a fortune. There is in the same study, the researchers also talked about a different girl though, whose name was Katerina. And she liked to play the game where she wanted to just basically make the zoos as beautiful as possible. And what she ended up doing was using a massive number of cheat codes to basically give herself unlimited amounts of money and make the zoo as beautiful as possible without regard to, doing what the game supposedly tells you to do, which is to amass a fortune. And it's interesting because the word cheat code implies a certain ethical standard, but in fact, cheat codes are kind of provided often by game developers as a way for you to customize your game experience, so that if you don't like what they tell you should like about a game, you can go ahead and change it. So in her case, she said, I actually like to be a designer. So I'm going to make this Zoo Designer, not Zoo Tycoon, and I'm going to just keep using this cheat code until I get all the money I need to be able to do what I want to do, which is to do aesthetic design rather than play the simulation where I'm going to make a lot of money. And both of these players, both Katerina and, the other girls, Rachel, thank you. Actually, also, when the researchers interacted with them, had like a running critique of the game as well. I mean, they were playing the game, but they weren't completely sucked into the way that the game's laid out the world. So one thing that both of them complained about is the fact that as a zoo manager, you're completely free to go around clear-cutting all the trees and forests that you're building your zoo in with no particular penalties at all, which maybe is accurate in sheer dollar terms if you're building a zoo like that. But they were critiquing it and saying, well, there should be a cost because there's this huge ecological damage to the environment when you do that. And so they also demonstrated this ability to kind of stand back from the game and critique it from their own value system and then interact with the values that were implicit within the game. And I think that's worth looking into as well. I think one of the reasons why we're really interested in games is that they make you do things. It's not like a film, it's not like television, it's not like reading literature. It's true that in all of those, you're obviously actively engaged in what's going on, and you're sometimes doing a running critique in your head of what you're seeing. But games are unique in that you have to do something to make them move forward. And there's this one game that got a lot of attention last year. It was basically one of the hottest independent games it came out in 2007, but it broke in 2008, called Braid. And it's a very interesting game that ultimately is about obsession. I hope that's not too much of a spoiler. And in this game, you kind of have to keep doing certain things over and over again so you do it right. The game doesn't quite reveal that it's about obsession until you're most of the way through it. And what's interesting about it is that, going back to the idea of procedural rhetoric, you're doing the thing that the game is talking about. I mean, there's a story that runs through the game that's about a person chasing after something he obsesses about. What's really interesting is the fact that you as the player are enacting that obsession by the way that you play the game, because the way the game works is, any of you, probably most of you are familiar with Super Mario Brothers, it's like Super Mario Brothers, but where you can rewind in case you mess up, and you can rewind and you can, you know, I was always terrible at that game, so I would jump and I was always jump into the lava pit and then have to go all the way back to the beginning. And in this game, if you jump in the lava pit, you just hit rewind. So you essentially can do this task over and over and over again until you actually land where you're supposed to land and move on. So the game is actually getting you to, as the player, to enact obsession. Now, the question becomes, do you actually know that that's what you're doing? And there's a lot of hints in the game that, you know, try to point you in that direction, that tie the story together with what you're doing. But if you go to most of the message forums that are dedicated to this game, you'll find that most people really haven't, either aren't really thinking about it or maybe haven't even realized it. So this is why reflection becomes a really important part of getting people to really get something out of the game. To go back to the story of Rachel and Zoo Tycoon, there's a real teachable moment there when you look at how she's behaving within the game and how she treats her animals. And when you ask the question, well, would you do this in real life? Because if she were a zoo manager in real life, she would have a budget that she has to balance. She wouldn't just be able to spend limitless amounts of money on keeping animals happy. So what would she do if given difficult choices that are realistic to that environment? And I think that's one of the things that games could put you in the position of. But without this reflection, without somebody or something asking you to think about what you're doing, would you realize that those are the choices that you're making? I think that's a really important aspect of where games could become a stronger tool for pro-social learning. And when the players like Rachel are critiquing the game for why it doesn't have any penalty for cutting down trees, that's another jumping off point where you could say, well, what should the game represent? Something that you could do is have people build new games and have their own value structures embedded in them. So those are some wonderful opportunities. One of the things that's really interesting and exciting right now for people who are researching pro-social learning is we're learning a lot about moral psychology right now, especially from an evolutionary dimension, about how our brains work and how basically moral judgments and ethical judgments fire at kind of the neuron level in our brains. And we're finding that there's just certain biases that we have that, you know, some of the theories hold are kind of embedded from our evolutionary history. So there's this classic philosophy question of what's the right thing to do when you have, the trolley problem of there's a trolley hurtling out of control down the tracks and there's a fork in the tracks and there's like five workers on one and one worker on the other, and should you throw the switch so that the trolley only runs over one worker rather than five, right? And it turns out most people would say, yes, you should throw the switch. But then if you pose essentially the same question, which is there's only one track and the trolley is hurtling out of control, there's still five workers on the track, but now there's this very large innocent bystander standing on a bridge on top of the tracks. Should you push the guy over the bridge to block the trolley because he's so big that the trolley would stop if it hit him? And in that case, pretty much the answer is no. And it turns out that there are there's brain activity that fires when you're posed with that kind of question. Actually, it fires when you think about touching the person to push them over the bridge, off the bridge. And so there's these different kinds of biases that we have embedded in our brains that lead us to certain moral conclusions about the world. And as the world becomes more and more global and complex, I would argue that some of these instincts may not be, may be counterproductive. We have, for example, a very strong bias, and we can argue about this on a philosophical level, but just we have a strong bias towards the people who are closer to us rather than people who are far away. So that it's easier for us to give charity to people who are down the street than it is to think about the billions of people who are living in poverty all around the world. That's just something that's built into the way that our brains are wired. They've even found people who do philanthropy and fundraising have found that showing different numbers of needy people in photographs actually leads to different amounts of money donated, so that if you have one starving child on the postcard, you'll actually raise a lot more money than if you have five. And you'll raise a lot more money if you have five starving children than if you give statistics. And so that kind of raises a different question for me, which is games are really, really good at illustrating systems. And is there a way to flip this around so that we can show how these really complicated systems that we all exist in today have these moral elements to them? If we're having trouble leaping from kind of this the kind of individual charity cases to global justice, as it were, can games help us gain some better insight into what our moral responsibilities might be on a systemic level, whether it's economic or ecological? Can we see these really complex global systems as having moral elements, and what role can games play in that because they're so good at modeling systems? A lot of these psychology research questions turn out to actually be built on games. There's one that proved really eye-opening for me. That's called I don't know if you've read the book Predictably Irrational, but there's one of the experiments they ran with that was a game known as the door game, where you click on different doors and get points for clicking on different doors. And what you begin to find is that the best strategy is to stick with one door and keep getting, rather than switching back and forth. But they found that if they cause the doors to shrink, if you don't click on them, people will actually spend points to try to keep those doors open, even though they're kind of losing points overall. They'll end up with a much lower score than they just stuck with one door. Exactly the same setup as the first iteration of the game, with the only difference being that the doors are shrinking in the second visually, and yet completely different behaviors. So that's basically the game that I had played online. Obviously you can see the graphics here, not a very exciting game that caused me at least to reflect on my own kind of actions and behaviors that is grounded in some knowledge of human psychology. And again, there's opportunities here to start integrating these into games. And that ultimately goes to the question of learning about your different values and learning about the world versus actually doing something. And this goes back to the point we were making about actually changing not just attitudes and ways of thinking, but actually changing behaviors. I kind of have a bit of skepticism about a lot of different educational efforts, and I've been in education for a while, because of that really difficult transference problem, that knowing that what you're teaching is going to actually affect somebody when it comes time to make a difficult choice. And so some other ways to think about what games have to teach us about changing behaviors would include, for example, what are commonly called augmented reality games. And I use the word game really, really expansively. So I'd think of the Prius game. The dashboard that you have that keeps track of your miles per gallon changes behaviors. My mother-in-law has a Civic hybrid, and it has absolutely changed the way that she thinks about how she drives, because she knows what behaviors causes her to maximize her points, essentially. And in fact, I think the Honda Insight actually has a game where you're growing trees. As the more gas you save, the bigger the more kind of leafy the forest becomes. So that actually is essentially a video game, which instead of using controllers, you're using your gas pedal to play the game and your brakes. So another game that I think was probably one of the most influential of certainly of 2008 is the website my.barackobama.com, which the Obama campaign had used to get people to do lots of things like make phone calls to Iowa and go door to door and have house parties. One thing that they were doing was keeping track of, they gave you points for doing different kinds of activities. Now, I don't know that those points actually motivated anybody to do things, but it did give you a sense and a feedback loop about, were you doing productive things? Because a lot of people prefer to do things that are kind of easy and not necessarily productive for the sake of a political campaign. So here was an example of an effort to take game elements and mesh them with real life actions to shape behaviors to actually change the way people behave. You can think now, you know, you can think of this applied to what would be, you know, more clearly, you know, moral or ethical choices than politics. It's related to kind of a lot of school programs where you get points for doing things like service. And you can kind of argue that maybe that gives people the wrong incentive structure, but it's something to think about. You can also think about, especially these massively multiplayer games, as laboratories, as different ways to kind of draw the values out of people unconsciously, because you may not realize what values you hold. I would argue that these massively multiplayer games are big laboratories for experimenting with kind of political economics, where a game like World of Warcraft maintains, you know, 10 million players by satisfying not just existing players, but new players. And you can begin to ask questions like, well, how does that map onto immigration policies? Because there's you know, you need, or progressive taxation for that matter. Every once in a while, the creators of this game kind of have to readjust the powers of different kinds of spells or weapons or whatever, because they become too dominant, and you have to kind of figure out a way to make things fair for everyone, which is quite a lot like a lot of conversations we have in politics about, you know, how do we kind of level the playing field for all people? You know, maybe there's a way for us to kind of pull people's budget preferences even. And here's a, this is a game that was designed, I think this was an NPR game, to try to get people to think about their, how they would allocate the federal budget. This one I found is, even though it's pretty approachable, still a little too abstract, but in any event, there might be ways to get people to express their preferences without necessarily asking the question. But sometimes when you ask the question, it suddenly changes the way people answer the question. There might be ways to kind of discern people's behavior from different kinds of games. Another game I didn't have any, I didn't take any screenshots of is the Google Image Labeler game, which is a different way of harnessing people's work. You can think of that maybe tied together with these kinds of budget questions. Is there a way to kind of distribute the way that we are thinking about these issues? I think the problem, and I'll this will be the last point. I think that there's a lot for us to learn from video games, and my hope is that video games are going to start thinking more hard about how to convey moral values through the play, because we're increasingly using these interfaces in real life. So an example that's very obvious are remote gun operating technologies, where on the left, this is a screenshot from Call of Duty 4, a video game, and on the right is an actual remote operating interface for a gun turret, which is being used right now in Iraq and Afghanistan. The gunner is actually only feet away from the gun, so it's not like they're being completely removed from the experience. But we also have people who are piloting Predator drones in Nevada that are flying literally halfway across the world. And these interfaces matter. These interfaces, you know, if you were able to reduce your targets down to just a bunch of pixels, what does that mean about the way that you interact with them? Do you think about the moral implications of what you're doing? The answer right now is still yes. And the answer right now is that people who are piloting predator drones in Nevada turn out to actually have higher incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder than the people who are on the ground. So right now, at least, there isn't a disconnect that the interface is helping to propagate. But it's something that we need to think about as we move forward, because this is only going to get more and more prevalent as time goes by. And the challenge that I leave people with is, how do we re-imbue this kind of face-to-face morality when we talk about the biases we have as people? A lot of those biases are grounded in the fact that society for millennia was a face-to-face tribal society. As we become increasingly bureaucratic, how do we re-imbue, this is a benefits, food stamp benefits application for Massachusetts. It's a very good example, and you just imagine the computer screen version of this. It's a very good example of how we've bureaucratized our relationships to each other. Is there a way in which we can learn from the values that are being evoked in video games, that we can re-imbue these bureaucracies, these systems that we're currently using, these interfaces that we're currently using, that have historically been dehumanizing? Can we rehumanize them? Can we find a way to take an interface like this and give it the same moral depth as a face-to-face interaction with somebody who really needs to feed her family that night? So those are some of the questions that I leave open, and we'd love to have a conversation with you about any of the topics we've raised here. I'd particularly like to, even though I've done this entire presentation, Scott and I have been co-authoring this, and Scott is very expert in moral and character development. We have folks here from the Good Play Project who've been doing real research into how kids are actually interacting with different kinds of digital media, and WGBH has had a lot of experience also with kids interacting with media, so I'm not planning on answering all the questions that people have.
Have there been any experiments done where they've taken a certain type of game and just reskinned it and see if you got different reactions? So if you took, say, a very violent game where you're shooting terrorists or aliens, and you change it to now you're shooting flowers at Care Bears or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think some of the research into aggression has found that it's almost the nature of video games itself, that the twitchiness of it, to go into evolutionary psychology, that you've gone into like kind of defensive mode, you're in danger mode, so that if the actual behavior you're enacting rather than the imagery you're seeing is need to have instant twitch reaction, that's what kind of stimulates the aggression. Now, on the other hand, the thing is, once you stop doing that, I mean, does that have any lasting influence? That's kind of a question. So, you know, there's many different levels of this. So on the kind of the most basic psychological level, a twitch game will kind of raise your general kind of fear of the world, because that's what's triggering in your brain. But does that actually change your overall kind of set of values about the world? That's kind of these are two separate questions. So the answer is I don't know about that specific question. I know that there were some people who were playing with that idea. I don't know that they ever got around to at MIT, where they were going to replace Counter-Strike with like your hand. Like, instead of having a gun, you would actually have your hand, and instead of having the sounds of sampled guns, they were going to have, you know, kids making sounds going bam, bam. And they were doing that as an art experiment, but I would actually love to see that done as a psychological or some other kind of experiment to see what's the difference between the activity there. Bill.
Great presentation. Thank you. The token economy was clear and on screen. There were a lot of dollar signs, and your Zoo Tycoon examples, the kids knew how to deconstruct the game and be aware of the number crunching. For me, the standout is the Nintendogs, where that's really not apparent, and yet it still seems to provoke, when I've played it or seen it played, this even a richer kind of experience where you're kind of oblivious to how what the numbers are that are controlling the dog, and you stroke it until it chases its tail. And there is a token economy on the back of Nintendo where you can buy and sell pet products, but that doesn't seem to be the key of it. Is there something that we can learn between things that run with tokens and run kind of more obliquely? Is that something?
Meanwhile, I mean, just an immediate thought is, so Gene alluded to, transferability being an enormous challenge in sort of all educational endeavors. And what strikes me is the difference between the Nintendo, Nintendogs brings you one degree closer to reality, right? Like, instead of sort of doing X to get the dollar, which leads to reward, it's you're doing X because your dog prospers, sure. Your virtual dog prospers. And so, I guess I think you're onto something in the sense that it seems like the closer the video game can get to reducing that transferability gap, it seems likely that the more likely they are to be successful in that transfer.
Because the temptation is to do the kind of that Star Wars model where you just get moral points and you watch your points go up and down, but I haven't played that, but it just struck me that when I'm not aware of it, the Nintendogs seem to be more kind of successful at that.
And it's interesting to think about with the Star Wars, for instance, if instead of getting the points, let's say, for doing a moral act, if you become, strong, if there was some sort of viable physical way within the game to be rewarded, I guess, more organic, more realistically, so to speak.
There is some debate within the kind of the video game research as to what is a game and what isn't a game. And Nintendogs is often considered kind of very borderline as a game, because there's not kind of a victory endpoint. You just kind of keep playing until you're tired of it. But you know, what's interesting to me about a lot of these is can we find other ways of rewarding people for doing things? And so the reward for petting your dog is that your dog is happy. You know, you don't have to have points for that. You know, when you look at Rock Band, it's fun because you're getting points. You can play more excellently or less excellently, but you can also imagine a version of that which kind of rewards you for being creative. I guess you could just do that in real life, but I mean, it's pretty hard to be in a real Rock Band, and one of the nice things about the game is it simplifies it for you. So there's different approaches to this that are you know, you can debate the semantics of whether it is a game or it isn't a game, but that's but that is a different way of thinking about the rewards. And I would love to see there is some reflection of kind of cultural, of how these things are culturally reflect our cultural values as well. So a lot of Japanese games there involve like different kinds of village interactions where you like Harvest Moon, for example, and that kind of a game, you have to kind of be aware of everybody else in the village and what their likes and dislikes are, and you need to keep up your relationships with all of them, and you need to give them their gifts on their birthdays and find out whether they do or don't like this particular kind of flower. These are things you very rarely see in kind of Western video games. So there's a reflection of our different kind of values there, and there's no particular reward for giving people gifts on their birthdays other than your general reputation in the village rises. So there are these different kinds of, and I don't know if like Western thought and philosophy leans towards a point system morality approach. I'm not sure that there might be something there. I don't know.
If I could, one little thing to add to that. Yeah, so Rick Schwader, who's an anthropologist at the University of Chicago, sort of makes this argument that societies, their ethical structures are sort of based on either an ethic of autonomy, an ethic of community, an ethic of divinity. And you know, in the U.S., we're very weighted towards an ethic of autonomy, like teenagers, you know, in particular, but really the majority of Americans, like, are really privileged individual rights, like, when kind of thinking about our ethics. So, you know, and Gene sort of alluded to, you know, some other cultures being much more weighted towards an ethic of community. And it seems to me that one way in which video games have the potential to be valuable is, you know, in through their procedural rhetoric, you know, kind of that combination of content and rules, sort of shifting kids' thinking towards, you know, oh, suddenly I'm in this world where an ethic of community is privileged, and I have to sort of make my way through this world with this new ethic. You know, again, you might run into this transferability problem. It's, you know, it's very easy to turn off the game and go straight back to, you know, the ethic of autonomy. But I'm sort of very interested in that.
A lot of co-op games and team games, which in some ways blend right into sports. I mean, it's almost like the same as sports. Are you learning a lot of teamwork and working together? That's...
One is some of the massively multiplayer games. People play for hours at a time. And there's a, you know, growing
days.
Literature about how it in essence becomes virtual reality. Whether it's, you know, not actual virtual reality, but people, their skin expands sort of through the keyboard into the other world. And so games like World of Warcraft or structured games where there's the script is controlled, it teaches competitiveness, but it also teaches cooperation, what you were saying, among your teammates, and versus games like Second Life, where totally unstructured and there's no agenda. And so I just wondered your thoughts both about the reality piece of gaming, and you really are living in a different world. You have it's like a dream, very, very vivid extended dream where you have memories as if this really happened.
It sort of points to the potential of video games, right? In the sense that, you know, so Elaine Scarry, who's a professor, you know, in the English department, she has this famous essay called The Difficulty of Imagining Other Persons, where she really argues that literature, you know, despite our sort of beliefs that literature has this incredible capability to transport us into other people's shoes, that actually literature is very limited, like, in its ability to do that. You know, and actually Adam Smith, like, way back in the 1700s, made the same argument that, you know, if you sort of read a story about an earthquake in China, that, you know, 30 seconds later, you're sort of back into your own world. You know, Gene noted some of the ways in which video games are more interactive than, you know, than literature or film. And so it seems like there's some potential there for, you know, for greater opportunities and perspective taking. I mean, your question may have been more weighted towards the dangers of, you know, spending 3 days in, you know, or opportunities.
Yeah.
But I guess
right.
My immediate thought is about the opportunity that the medium presents.
Carrie, I don't know if you guys have any research in this area on that question or findings.
Very close to
Well, I do just first off think of one of our subjects who was one of these players of World of Warcraft who'd been playing for hours every day for a very long time, and it became an important part of his life, and he had to give up the game. And in our interview, I asked him if it was hard, and he said that after quitting, he dreamt about playing the game for weeks on end after quitting, because it was such a vivid thing for him that it was as if reliving other parts of his day, except his day had been on World of Warcraft. As far as, I mean, just in terms of multiplayer games, which I know, Gene, you didn't address as much, because it's in many ways a very different thing, I think there is a lot of potential there, too, for perspective taking and things like that, because in addition to a lot of the benefits of games that Gene talks about, you have the actual experience of working with other people who are other humans, you know, behind other characters, which creates different stakes, and it also creates a certain amount of complexity in terms of the moral decisions that you would have to make, because it's actually, you're making them about real people. I don't know if that really gets specifically to your question, but I agree, there's potential.
I mean, there is research that, admittedly, kind of in industry side research, so not academic research, that is showing that there are leadership skills being developed and things like that. What I'd be very curious about from my perspective is who is learning those, because my guess is that the privileged people who are entering these worlds are the ones who are kind of sharpening their leadership skills rather than kind of people who come in without those skills who are developing them. It's a little bit like the Sesame Street effect, like where the idea of Sesame Street was to kind of narrow the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and what they initially found was that because the haves were watching the TV show with their parents, they were actually getting disproportionately more benefit out of watching Sesame Street than the kids who were just kind of parked in front of the TV. It could be that everybody's benefiting, but actually the haves are benefiting more, and I'm very curious as to whether that's true in these multiplayer games where the people who are learning teamwork are the ones who already have a lot of teamwork skills. Yep.
Very good presentation. I fully agree with your conclusions, but I got a doubt. Sort of referring to a broader context, and it's personal with no theory behind it. Since my daughter was born 3 years ago, I haven't had time at all for playing games, and I don't regret it at all. I mean, I think that children can teach you much more about your personality, about your limits, and so on. But also before that, I hadn't been a fan of video games, because it's the question of what you choose, whether you choose to spend time playing games or dating a girl or having a beer with your friends or reading a book. Personally, I always had this feeling that the other things are more sort of productive, mm-hmm. personally and probably socially. And also the problem that I have personally with video games is that it's like food from Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's. It's easy, right? You can take it easy, it's cheap, and you can always revert the consequences, right? While in the real life, mm-hmm. you can just say, well, I'm not going to play it anymore, right? I quit. It's so I have this feeling that all the video games, cruel or not cruel, are sort of substitute, most often quite poor substitute of the real life. It's like comparing McDonald's with a dinner in a French restaurant.
Do you feel the same way about basketball, like playing basketball? Or soccer, you know?
Yeah. But it's also, that's the same thing. You can play soccer or basketball while playing a game, or you can just meet your friends and play it in the real life. I personally, I've always chosen the second option.
I'm curious if any of the programs here, but I mean, in sort of your work with teenagers, like I'm just wondering if you have sort of thoughts on how they kind of constitute socialization. It's because your argument seems to be sort of that, like there's sort of more fuller ways of socializing.
Well, that's my personal impression.
Yeah, for sure.
Without any generalization in it.
Talk about NSS.
Other people here,
maybe I have to say I'm not a gamer, you know, but I keep watching people why they play game and why they don't. You know, because if we define the first life, you know, as the one polar, another polar as the second life, you know, we can find people in the spectrum, you know, and maybe the gamer in the another side. But my question is actually about the methodology, how to research the social impact, the antisocial or social, you know, effects, you know, of game players, you know. Because I think it's very hard, for example, I'm studying social media, we have to identify people's identities, you know, on the cyberspace, you know. But for gamers, it's very hard because they always create their anonymous identity online or in a specific game sphere, you know. So what's the methodology could be possible to study the social
effect, to you guys.
Sure. You know, and back to their first life to study their behavior change. So this kind of, I think it's big issue to me.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that's a good question. It's, and it's one of the challenges, definitely, for sure. I mean, because it's pretty easy to try to measure things like, you know, sort of measure attitudinal change. You know, there's plenty of measures. You know, values change. Like there's plenty of measures. You know, with some of the work that Gene was talking about before. You know, some researchers in Notre Dame had students, kind of kids playing, you know, a violent video game and then a pro-social video game and then doing some sort of writing. About taking some elements of a story and putting it into a story, and then the researchers kind of measured the level of aggression or pro-social sort of characteristics of those stories. But the question of whether that kind of then translates into real life is the big question. Like, you know what I mean? You know, there's been probably maybe the best work has been qualitative research as a result. You know, there's been some, I mean, the PZ is doing some of the big work, and then there's some groups out in California that have been doing a lot of work, right, on looking at teenagers in their real environments, playing video games and using the internet. And I guess I could probably let you.
Well, the way we found our subjects was just, where do you find teenagers? You find them in school, you find them in college, you find them online, actually, through Craigslist or things like that, and you do a survey and find out, you know, what they're doing, and then from there, interview.
Continuously tracking them. So only based on sampling of survey.
And through the interviewing of our subjects, talking about what's important to you in your offline life, who has had the biggest influence on you, and then moving into the online life. How did you learn to do this? Who taught you? Was it in school? Was it at home? Things like that kind of gives you a fuller picture of the person. And to your, we did interview game players, and one subject said he learned to be a person through the game that he played. He was homeschooled, didn't have much interaction with peers, and the game environment allowed him to learn, how do I work in a group? And when he actually went back to school, it was a very, back to a public school, it was very important. He kind of learned through that game, how do I talk to others? And but a lot of the gamers that we spoke to were, I would say, average teenagers, average young adults who had a active social life, and this was just kind of another part of it, much like if you had friends who were on a sports team or friends that you had a beer with, these were just friends that happened to play as, you know, blood elves or whatever.
What's interesting about a lot of the research in this area is it's hard to establish, like, even old media. I guess at this point you can almost, like, movie violence and TV violence translates into real world behavior. I think that debate is still ongoing. I mean, and so that this is incredibly difficult research to do in terms of trying to establish causation as opposed to just correlation, which are actually very different from a policy perspective. One thing I should just note about going back to your question also is one of the interesting findings from the research that was summarized in Grand Theft Childhood, which I referred to before, one of the few statistical studies, is that in teenage boys, they found that the correlation between these antisocial behaviors and gameplay was strongest at that kind of the two extremes. The kids who played lots and lots and lots of violent games tended to be strongly correlated with antisocial behavior. But then the boys, not the girls, the boys who didn't play any games whatsoever also had an interesting correlation. And the theory, I mean, there's no...
Meaning also had high levels.
Yeah, they had negative behaviors exhibited in school. And the theory was is that it's definitely not causation. It's that these kids were kind of like not part of the culture in their schools. And that kind of led them to either be bullied or bullied back and all these different other kinds of negative behaviors, because playing games is such a part of boy culture at that age that it's kind of more of an indicia that you're not kind of connecting with your peers, either because of choice or, I don't know, I doubt it's deprivation, but, you know, who knows. So that's just an interesting little statistical blip that came out of that research that's kind of tantalizing. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, one thing was with respect to why you think there is this tendency to try to look seriously or not so seriously in the press very often for causation in these situations, rather than seeing games as a natural extension of somebody's sphere of action, and therefore somebody that's more violently inclined would also exhibit that perhaps more in games. Not necessarily, and I don't think always are that, but that could be the case. And why do you think that, a different question perhaps, is why do you think that we're looking for value in games? Why do we have this extreme aversion to wasteful activities? And why can't play be its own reward? That's because of the various questions that came up. I thought about.
Well, I tend to think, as a political matter, you know, first of all, we're talking about media competing with media, so, you know, video games are actually eating into other media, so it's almost like a protective response. But I mean, there's also just this kind of morality play that goes around that we want to at a cultural level we want to actually establish what we believe are norms about what behavior is. So I think that that's a natural reaction from that perspective to try to say these things. And anytime a new medium comes along, and this goes way, way back to the novel, to, well, actually even books, the novel, graphic novels, comic books, film, television, each one of these always, there was always this like, oh my God, this is gonna destroy our culture. And to some extent, actually it did, right? Because the culture gets remade in a new way once a new medium is part of it. So there's always that kind of hand-wringing whenever something new comes along. But you know, your second question is interesting to me, because I do think of video games as an art form, and I think that art is rarely art without something deeper and meaningful to it. So apart from this kind of like more prosaic, will it change your behavior, will it you know, cause people to go around shooting each other or whatever, my deepest personal interest is in seeing better art, essentially. I would like to see more meaningful games. I do believe most of the games out there are fairly shallow and don't really say all that much about the world. You don't really learn all that much about the human condition through them. And I feel like that's similar to like the early days of film and television. You know, it takes a long, long time for these media to fully ripen and get to the point where you have, you know, great TV shows or great films that you can, you know, interact with and learn something about yourself and the world.
Your last comment, but then it comes by Ethan, who's watching the webcast. So his question is, why are games built to teach social lessons so often terribly boring? And he points to sort of two examples. One example is a game on the UNICEF website that's it's a game about poverty in Haiti, and it's a very informative game about poverty, but not a ton of fun to play. And the other example he points to is called Iced on Breakthrough.tv, which is a something against a deportation game. And so his ultimate question is, are morals and good gameplay incompatible?
That's a really good question. I think part of it is this bias towards, again, this approach towards thinking that, well, to get people to think differently, we have to kind of tell them what to think and what to believe. And I think that's equally true of whether you're talking about television or video games or whatever. And I see the GBH people looking like they're about to leave. And I was actually going to hope that you might say just something quickly about how you avoid that problem with television. You know, because you can easily, there's like, I can think back to high school and remember all the various films which were just very, you know, didactic about what you should or shouldn't believe about the world. And how do you avoid that even in that in the medium of television?
Well, they look for humor when they can, even if the issues are it's tough to look for ways that the characters can resonate. I mean, Arthur as a TV series in its 14th year is dealing with cancer, with Lance Armstrong as a guest, but where one of the older characters has cancer. I mean, there's different entry points, as long as you can find a way to mediate it in a way that's still engaging in the kind of ways that characters now to do engage. But like I said, I mean, humor is often a way through. You know, we haven't dealt with deportation or hunger in the same way. I think that's the same and it did well without oil, I think, did,
right.
If I remember right. You know, that was a number crunching game that was got people into thinking of, you know, how would they be. So there's still an affinity that you're trying to build in any of these media. That's how we do it. Behaviors that we're trying to produce a more kid level
group. Right. You know, I mean, as far as Ethan's question is concerned, I just think that it's difficult to tackle values in a way that is not didactic. And whether it's whatever medium it's in, and it takes a lot of development of the art of using that medium well before you can actually do it in a way that's not just bluntly over the head. This is what's right and this is what's wrong, or isn't it terrible, you know, and to avoid propaganda. I feel like a lot of the games that are out there are propaganda games rather than games that are truly tackling the games that Ethan is referring to. Just if anybody is interested, by the way, next week is the Games for Change Festival in New York. Anybody who is interested in Games for Change, which kind of is specifically on the topic of games that are about social issues, should look into that. Carrie, did you have a response?
Us, because we're building curriculum based on our research to try to encourage young people to reflect about the implications of what they do. And I'm curious, related to Ethan's question, are there certain games, even commercially successful ones, that are very compelling that build in and require reflection?
Right.
And are those games especially poised to be, you know, encouraging ethical conduct and behavior?
Like, I mean, so I don't know a ton about video games, but I've learned a lot in the process of doing this work with Gene. And I mean, Grand Theft Auto, which obviously has gotten a lot of publicity. I mean, I wouldn't say that's a highly reflective game by any stretch of the imagination. But there's this one piece that I've kind of learned from Gene, which I find so fascinating, which is there's a point in the game where, like, if the main character Nico, I guess in this most recent version, kind of kills the wrong person. If I'm saying that right,
he kills a person.
The game actually sort of pauses, right? Like, it actually sort of forces, well, the character experiences regret about the...
Well, the character does say, says something about what's going on, and that's, it's not like the deepest, most, you know, poignant, reflective moment in any game, but because this is such a well-known antisocial game, it actually is pretty thoroughly antisocial, you know, and yet, nonetheless, there's this moment, there's this potential that you could see in there where you could say, well, wow, that actually stopped for a second just to comment on what was going on. That shows some potential. There's a lot of games right now that point the way that are met, like, that they don't make points about values in the big sense, but a lot of them, as you would kind of expect at this point in the medium, are making points about games themselves. So there are games that kind of confront issues like free will, because games give you the illusion of free will, and so there's a very AAA title, BioShock, that kind of tackled the question of free will because it deconstructs it. So there are games that are kind of now starting to make commentary about games in a very powerful, effective way, just like I was talking about with Braid and Obsession, which often is another thing that's like a meta commentary about games, is most games are kind of reward OCD behavior. And so you're kind of pointing the way towards games that might also cause you to pause and reflect about the values. But I would actually be really interested in a game that was, the gameplay was reflection itself, or some kind of moral response. So I'm thinking about the kind of the party game Scruples. And I'm wondering if it could become like a massively multiplayer online game, like where people are kind of voting on what they would do in a different kind of situation. I was recently reintroduced to that game, and I said to myself, wow, that's a really interesting game about values that you can easily imagine modeled in an online environment, as so it would be about the reflection rather than you reflect about it somehow separately from the game.
Separate from the game, that gamer forms might be
to
look for reflection.
Absolutely.
So from a methodological perspective, that might be one space. Have people already studied?
Well, people like Kurt Squire have been studying the culture around games. I do have to say that for the chapter, I was doing some research to try to find that reflection, and it turned out to be really hard, so I kind of disappointed myself. I mean, I didn't dig too deep, but like I was surprised, because maybe I go to different kinds of forums, but when I tried to do generic forums, it was a lot of discussion about optimizing various statistics or like different kinds of things, and the conversation about the values were often very oblique. You know, and you can kind of read between the lines and see that the people were struggling with some of the values questions, like, should I have killed this guy or should I have let him go? But then it would be concluded with, well, I decided to kill the guy because I get to see a different cutscene, which is a completely different reason for making that decision than because I thought it was the right thing to do, or because I wanted to do the wrong thing just to see what would happen, or whatever the case might be. So I would love to see someone do like a large scale analysis of these forms just to see what they are, because it turned out to be pretty hard for me to find that reflection, and it was counter my expectations when I started looking. But this was not a methodological approach. It was just like I was just trying to find something, and it was actually quite difficult. Yeah. So we're actually out of time, but I would really love any other feedback that you might have. We're still in the process of finalizing this chapter and would love to incorporate more ideas and thoughts. So thanks again. Hope you get to enjoy the day and not just in virtual reality.